The Senate's Environment Natural Resources Policy will come to order. Welcome back to the 2008 session, and I hope everyone had a great interim. And I just wanted to say hello again and look forward to working with everyone this session. First of all, I'd like to introduce some new staff. As you may or may not have known, Carol Baker left the Senate this interim, and now she's been replaced with Carlin Doyle, who will be the new committee counsel. Carlin, give us a little bit of your background.
Okay. My name is Carlin Doyle, and I started here just a couple weeks ago. My background is in the insurance industry, working at St. Paul Travelers Government Affairs area, also a spinoff of St. Paul Travelers and United Healthcare, working in the regular compliance and government affairs areas. And I'm looking forward to working with all of you. Thank you.
Any new staff that we need to introduce? Marianne, would you go over for the committee kind of the...
It's okay, thank you.
Give a general sketch of the timeline for the session, because we've got a short session, then we've got even shorter deadlines.
Yep.
If you wouldn't mind pulling the microphone.
Thank you. We're out of there again. We have meetings scheduled with bills through February 27th. This Wednesday, there are two bills, Senator Olsen's bill and Senator Rest's bill, the ballast water bill. The following week, February 25th is Senator Marty's clean car bill, and on Wednesday the 27th, Senator Anderson's cap and trade program bill. The remaining committee meetings need to get scheduled, but there will be game and fish and lands and some of the usual items, and an omnibus bill that Senator Chaudhry will be presenting.
And I see no other way to accommodate all the bills that are coming in but to have some night meetings, but we will let you know when those bills occur. And process-wise, it will be the way we'll handle the bills will be the same as last year. We will hear the bills. Those that have to go to another committee, we will vote on. Those that do not, we will lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus environment policy bill. And then we will lay out that policy bill, that omnibus bill, the draft of it before the hearing before we vote on it, so that there is an opportunity to review it and prepare any amendments as such. Any questions? If not, today we're going to hear about the statewide conservation and preservation plan. A couple of years ago, the legislature authorized several hundred thousand dollars for the creation of a statewide conservation plan to find out, put kind of all together what we need to do as a state for conservation in a variety of disciplines. That was part of an LCMR appropriation. Over the interim, maybe I'm not getting my timeline right, but in this past year, the LCMR chose through a request for proposal process, chose an entity, the University of Minnesota, to come up with that conservation plan. And so the conservation plan is not yet finished, but it is getting there. And so I thought as we start this session in the Environment Policy Committee, we start with an overview of where we are and places we would like to be. So with that, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Great. Thank you very much. My name is Jean Coleman with CR Planning, and I appreciate the opportunity, Chairman Chaudhry and members, to present an update or an introduction to the LCCMR Statewide Conservation and Preservation Plan. As Senator Chaudhry mentioned, The LCCMR did award a contract about a year and a half ago to the University of Minnesota Institute on the Environment in partnership with Bonestro and CR Planning to create a statewide conservation and preservation plan for the LCCMR. I want to start by saying that Deb Swackhammer, who is the interim director for the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota, was unable to be here today, and she sends her regrets, and hopefully I'll be able to stand in her stead. With me today, there are three individuals from the team to present portions of the project that they've been working on. David Mullah from the University of Minnesota, John Charlo from Bonestro, and Sangwon Su from the University of Minnesota, and each of them will have a part in the presentation today. I would encourage and we would welcome questions during our presentation, anything that you would like to have clarified or any information that you would like to ask. So feel free to interrupt us, and Chairman Chaudhry, I imagine there's a protocol for that that I'll follow your lead on.
Thank you.
The project goal for the LCCMR Statewide Conservation Preservation Plan is very big: to achieve a better future for Minnesota's natural resources. But the project itself is very directed and strategic. We have two phases in the project. We're in phase two, and I will refer to these two phases through the presentation. The first phase, it was to develop a common understanding of the status of Minnesota's resources and the drivers of change that are causing change in those resources. Based on that understanding, phase two is to look and develop and make recommendations on useful tools to produce a better outcome for Minnesota's natural resources, the final product being what we're calling an environmental strategic plan. The phase one, as I said, was creating a common understanding of change and the drivers of change. That document was completed in July of 2007 and revised in September of 2007 and is available on both the LCCMR website and on the project website, which is the address of which is in the brochure that you've all received. We also have a few copies of the final document for phase one, the background report, available to committee members. Several of your committee members are also LCCMR members, so they have received it. And if anyone else is interested, these are available at the front of the table. Very briefly, our work in phase one was we brought about 45 team members together with a broad range of experience and a high level of scientific knowledge to tackle the questions of what is the status of Minnesota's natural resources, land, water, air, fish, wildlife, outdoor recreation, and to analyze the drivers that are changing those resources. We identified those drivers of change and prioritized them in order to direct our second phase work. We also identified cross-cutting drivers of change, also to prioritize our second phase work. Very simply and graphically, what we are doing and intend to do is to look at the historical trend for natural resources, and this example includes lakeshore development and its impact on our water quality, lakeshore development being a driver of change. And we're looking at the historical trend, and if that historical trend is extended in the future without any policy or change in actions, then where will we be? And then in the second phase, developing policies and actions or investment strategies for the LCCMR that will change that trend and produce a better outcome for Minnesota's resources. This is a very simple diagram of how we analyzed those drivers of change and their effect on Minnesota's resources. The little stick figure up there may be comical, but really it all does come back to us and how humans impact the environment. And so ultimately, we are at the top, and we are the cause of change to resources. That did not enable us as a team, though, to look just at human actions. We needed to break that down into actions that had direct impact on natural resources. And if you look at the right-hand side of that diagram, we have a simple illustration of that causal drivers of change chain going from development, demographics, what people do, where they live, what they consume, to a subset of that, which is how we consume or develop shoreline areas. And then finally, the impact of nutrient loading, which is caused by shoreline development, and its impact on fish and water. The world is not as simple as that last diagram, though, and we did look at how drivers of change at each of those levels affects multiple resources and affects other drivers. So this diagram that we lovingly call our spaghetti diagram shows a little bit more of the intricacies of how drivers of change cause impact on resources, the resources being at the bottom. And if you had time to spend with this diagram, you would notice a couple of things, and I'll just highlight one, that shoreline development causing nutrient loading does have an effect on fish. It also has an effect on water, and that fish are at the bottom of the chain, and many of the drivers of change affecting land, affecting air, affecting water, ultimately also affect fish. From there, we identified seven key issues that we sorted through in the drivers of change to proceed in our research in the second phase. And those seven key issues are illustrated here, and they're not in any particular order. Land and water, habitat, fragmentation, degradation, conversion, and loss is at the top, one of those drivers of change, one of those key issues. The impact of resource consumption, particularly groundwater consumption, was also identified as the key issue causing our change in Minnesota's resources. Toxic contaminants, energy production and use, transportation, land use practices, and invasive species were the other key issues that we identified. In phase two, we're not tackling all of those key issues, but we are taking on a majority of those, and particularly the ones that have cross-cutting impacts on multiple natural resources. The highlighted issues on this slide, land and water, habitat, fragmentation, degradation, conversion, and loss, is one of the issues that we are researching in phase two. Energy production and use, with a subset of looking at mercury emissions as a toxic contaminant, we're also looking at in phase two. And land use practices, including transportation, is our third focus area for phase two. Moving then on to the process for phase two, and then I will hand it over to our team members who are leading research teams on those issues. We are to be completed with our phase two analysis by June of 2008 to report to the LCCMR to enable them to use the recommendations as they choose to inform their request for proposals in the future. The type of products that we are producing for phase two include mapping of priority areas, mapping of land habitat priority areas, aquatic habitat priority areas throughout the state, creating a set of recommended conservation strategies of two types, the first being how the LCCMR can invest their dollars in, for example, protection priorities, research, pilots, and demonstration projects. But we will also be suggesting policy changes that will produce a better outcome for Minnesota's natural resources. So very strategic for the LCCMR, but also suggesting more broad policy changes. The third product we'll be producing in our phase two are trend analysis supporting our recommendations. Going back to that trend analysis slide, we'll be making recommendations that we think will improve the trend of Natural Resources in Minnesota for a Better Outcome, and we'll be showing the analysis to support those conclusions. And finally, we will be evaluating our conservation strategies in two ways. One, through a qualitative cost-benefit analysis, and secondly, through stakeholder outreach, talking to stakeholder organizations about the draft recommendations. This slide just illustrates the number of experts that we have brought to this project, which I think is just wonderful, sometimes overwhelming as a project coordinator. Each of the teams, the Land and Aquatic Habitat team, the Land Use Practices and Transportation team, the Energy Production and Use team, the types of team members are illustrated here, and the number of them. The cost-benefit analysis team also, and then we have a fairly broad support team, particularly in GIS, geographic information systems, and data support. Now I'd like to turn the talk over to Professor David Mulla, but first, are there any questions about process, which was my charge for the day? If not, then Professor Mulla will be talking about how the energy team is proceeding, and please do take advantage of the opportunity to ask questions if you've got them, because Professor Mulla has to leave and go teach a class later, so he'll be leaving fairly soon after his presentation.
Thanks, Jean, and good afternoon, honorable members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. It's really a pleasure to be here and to speak with you, and I appreciate the invitation to our group. I'm at the University of Minnesota. I'm a fellow in the Institute on the Environment. I'm the director of the Precision Ag Center, and I'm also the Larson Chair for Soil and Water Resources in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate. And I've been working a lot on natural resource issues for the last 13 or 14 years. We have a team to address the conservation needs that relate to energy production and use. And our overall products for this second phase are listed on this slide. We intend to identify some of the trends in alternative energy production and the impacts of those trends, including the areas of biofuels and alternative energy and fuel conservation. We also intend to develop and map priority natural resource areas that are likely to be affected. For instance, resources that include our soils, our groundwater, our surface waters, our wildlife, and our atmosphere. We also intend to identify energy-related investment and policy choices that impact natural resources. So this would be a way in which we can perhaps develop a future that is good for the environment as well as good for the economy, that is sustainable, and that meets a lot of our competing needs for things like food, energy, wildlife habitat, recreation, and a clean environment. This is a broad overview of what we intend to do in this particular component of the project. We want to look at three overarching scenarios for energy and environmental policy that are relevant to sustainable energy production. The first scenario is simply a continuation of current energy and environmental policy and incentives, both at the federal and the state level. And so when the federal government says that we need to produce 36 billion gallons of ethanol from renewable sources, that's certainly one of the current trends that we'll be taking into account. The second, though, is to look at what would happen to liquid fuel needs or demands if we were to encourage a shift to policies and practices that promote significant conservation of energy and alternative energy sources. So this would be distinctly different from the first scenario. And our third scenario would combine the second scenario with one in which we develop policies and practices that promote significant environmental benefits from land use practices. And these would be benefits such as erosion control, improved use of our groundwater and sustainable groundwater usage, protection of water quality, attainment of our total maximum daily loads in our rivers and lakes, reestablishment of vibrant wildlife populations and things of that nature. For each of these scenarios, we want to identify the trends, evaluate some of the alternative energy options, and recommend strategies for reaching those options. Within those overarching scenarios, we want to look at a couple of options, specific options that almost everybody's talked about. And the first of the three major options is, of course, getting renewable energy from the corn-soybean rotation. That includes ethanol and biodiesel. And our current trends right now are for a conversion from the corn-soybean rotation to a corn-corn-soybean rotation. So from a 2 to a 3 year rotation where there's more corn produced as a result of the increased demand for ethanol. Of course, that has a kind of feedback loop in it. Price of soybeans has risen to about $12.50 a bushel, and now there's a lot of pressure to go back and plant more acres of soybeans. So, you know, the prices of the commodities really control how much land is planted to either corn or soybeans, and we're aware of that and looking at those scenarios. We also want to look at some future scenarios which would arrive when cellulosic ethanol production really becomes a reality. This would probably involve perennial crops on the landscape. Cellulosic ethanol can also be obtained from some corn-based products, such as corn cobs and corn stover, and we'll be looking at that as well. But among the options that we want to consider would be one in which we look at monocultures of perennial energy crops, such as switchgrass, miscanthus, hybrid poplar, willows, and others. And these would be grown not only in the areas where we now have corn and soybeans, but perhaps also we might be looking at hybrid poplar, willows, and other forest resources in the northern part of the state. We also want to look at a third option, which is polycultures of perennial energy crops. These would be things like grass-legume mixtures that David Tillman has studied, and native prairie plantings, which would go a long way towards reestablishing some of our native habitat in the state. For each of these overarching scenarios and options, we want to determine the expected pattern of these cropping systems on the landscape. And that means, in particular, we want to look at where our vulnerable resources are in terms of groundwater erosion, existing CRP land, native prairie plantings, wildlife refuges, and really kind of develop a plan for optimizing our landscape so that it can perform multiple functions.
Professor,
we also will determine
Mula,
the expected benefits and costs of each of those options. Sorry.
May I ask a quick question? In addition to those various landscapes, I know that there are also about 500,000 acres of kind of open land along our roadsides. And we have a roadsides wildlife program in the DNR in conjunction with MnDOT and various uses of those roadsides have been discussed. Have those acres factored into your evaluations as well?
We will certainly take that into account and look at, you know, the uses for that kind of land. That's very important in terms of its ability to filter out, you know, pollutants from the roads and to provide some habitat, although limited, for birds. So we'll definitely look at some of those options.
And areas for biofuels as well.
Yes, biofuels is, of course, the economic driver for a lot of the lands that are relatively marginal and vulnerable.
Thank you.
As I mentioned earlier, we'll look at the potential impacts of these scenarios and options on the environment. I've gone into that in some detail already. Let me just show you a couple of the current trends, which you're already fairly familiar with, I'm sure. Obviously, we have a growing demand for ethanol. And This is expected to come from both cellulosic and non-cellulosic sources, and the demand is expected to grow exponentially. Right now, we're producing about 7 billion gallons of ethanol in the country, and Minnesota is producing about 600 million gallons of ethanol, with another 2.5 billion gallons of ethanol expected to be produced in the next 3 to 5 years from corn.
7 billion currently across the country?
Yes. According
does
to
Minnesota have is that does Minnesota have the is that the single highest producer of ethanol? Is it the rest of it pretty much spread around the states, or is there a state that has even a higher amount than 600?
I think Iowa is a little bit ahead of Minnesota, but Minnesota is certainly in the top five. As you know, Minnesota was very proactive in legislating that 10% of the gasoline be blended with ethanol, or 10% of the gasoline be a blend of ethanol. So there's a readily available market for ethanol in the state of Minnesota. In the National Energy Policy Act, it's anticipated that the ethanol from starch produced by corn is going to be capped at about 15 billion gallons. And so the remainder of the ethanol is expected to come from cellulosic sources, such as switchgrass, hybrid poplar, and a wide variety of other types of crops, sugarcane, and even corn stover and corn cobs. So all of those would fulfill some of the rest of this demand for 36 billion gallons of ethanol. So these are the current trends and policies that we have in place today. And obviously, Minnesota is probably going to follow along with these trends, and a certain amount of our acreage is going to be devoted towards production of ethanol from corn, and another portion, which is expected to grow rapidly, will be from cellulosic sources. For the second overarching scenario that we want to look at, we're really concerned about what the state could do to promote energy conservation and alternative energy production, because I think there's a realization that agricultural land by itself cannot provide all of the liquid fuel resources for the country. We really need to develop alternative energies, and also we need to reduce or conserve our energy. So we're going to consider things like better mileage standards, electric plug-in cars, more mass transit, increased wind and solar energy, deep injection of carbon, and decreased carbon footprints in buildings so that we reduce our consumption of electricity. There are also other ideas that have been on the table, and your committee probably has other ideas which we'd be glad to hear about. But all of these will impact the demand for ethanol and for renewable energy on the landscape. So we'll factor those into our projections. This is an analysis that was done recently for the state of Minnesota to show which types of biofeedstocks currently would be the most useful for production of ethanol or from either cellulosic or non-cellulosic sources in Minnesota. The southern part of the state obviously is dominated by corn, the Red River Valley by sugar beets, the northern part of the state by aspen, and then we also have other resources such as softwood timber and municipal solid waste, soybean meal, urban wood waste, and wheat or flour grain. This is really kind of a reflection of what our resources are today. It doesn't really take into account some alternative crops that we're going to consider, such as switchgrass, hybrid poplar, willows, miscanthus, native prairie plantings, and legume prairie mixes. What we intend to do is gather together information about our natural resources, such as erosion potential, crop production potential, sensitive groundwater and wellhead protection areas, and other natural resources concerns, such as areas where we have the potential for expanding wildlife diversity and wildlife numbers. And we'll combine those with some of the production statistics that we have that were shown on the previous slide to come up with a matrix like this that shows productivity on one side, productivity of the landscape and the crops, and vulnerability of the landscapes on another axis. That's the x-axis. And really, you can divide this into a 2x2 matrix. And so you have areas which are low in productivity. These are marginal soils. A lot of those marginal soils are currently perhaps in the Conservation Reserve Program. They're retired. They have maybe a relatively low vulnerability. If you go across to the right side, you have low productivity and high vulnerability. These lands would certainly, a lot more of them would be in Conservation Reserve Program. They would be in the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. They would be wellhead protection areas and things of that nature. And for those areas, we were thinking that they would have a high suitability for growing perennial crops that would be very protective of the environment, but would still allow for economic gains and productive landscapes. On the other side of this matrix, where you have high productivity and low vulnerability, we're really thinking that those would be areas that would have a high suitability for annual cropping, and where we would get both food and fuel from the landscapes. We don't want to reduce the amount of landscape that's used to produce food, because we also have growing pressures to produce food, not only in Minnesota, but all over the world. So this just kind of gives you an overview of some of the things that our recommended policies and incentives will be trying to promote, which is focused towards getting more perennial crops on the most vulnerable landscapes, which represent relatively small portions of Minnesota's agricultural lands. That's the end of my brief introduction into what we intend to do in the Energy Production and Use team. I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have them.
Questions for Professor Mula? Thank you. Hold on. Senator Dill has a question.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Mula, I noticed that none of your ag options included livestock. Was there some reason to leave them out?
We actually had talked about that, but I didn't put those on the slides. Obviously, there's a lot of relationships between corn production, soybean production, and animal production. The majority of our corn and soybean production today is for animal feed, and as more and more of the corn is produced or used for ethanol production, that changes the feed prices, and it changes the availability and the nature of the feed, and we intend to look into that as well. Right now, dry distiller grains are being produced by ethanol plants, and a lot of that dry distiller grain is being fed back to animals. And as ethanol plants look for better ways to reduce their operating costs, they're looking at options that include using dry distiller grains to actually fuel the operation of the ethanol plants. So that could really lead to a situation where, feed prices increase and feed has to be imported from other places, and that's something that we certainly are aware of and will take into consideration.
Follow-up? Senator Dill, would you mind pulling your microphone closer? Thank you.
That's quite a long ways away. Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Dr. Mula, in the previous presentation by Gene Coleman, I didn't notice anything specifically in the area of planning and zoning to try to deal with the urban sprawl problem, conserve energy. You mentioned energy conservation, and it seems to me one of the important things would be to get people to live closer to where they work and play and go to school and go to church and so forth.
Yes, that would actually be addressed with better mileage standards and more mass transit and decreased vehicle miles traveled per person, which are scenarios that we're looking at. John Shardlow will talk in detail about some of those components and how they relate to the overall conservation plan. There's quite a lot of information in his presentation about that issue.
Okay. There's a whole topic on land use practice center deal that we're going to talk about.
Okay, good. Well, I have a bill up in front of Senator Vickerman's committee tomorrow that deals with urban sprawl that we heard in this committee last year, the Teddy Roosevelt Memorial Bill to preserve ag land, yep, open space, and yep, wildlife habitat, and so forth. Yep. And that gets at this issue also.
Very good. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got a bill in an upcoming committee hearing this afternoon on that very subject that will give local governments tools to do the same.
Professor Mulla, on your growing demand for cellulose biofuel slide, does the Energy Policy Act mandate a cap of 15 billion gallons of corn ethanol? Is that what we're reading here? And then how does that, could you explain what the Energy Policy Act is mandating and what the graph lines mean?
The Energy Policy Act states that we should develop 36 billion gallons of ethanol from both cellulosic and non-cellulosic sources, and it's anticipated that corn starch will contribute 15 billion gallons, or actually a little higher, maybe 16 billion gallons of that liquid fuel. There could be additional ethanol produced from cellulosic corn sources such as corn cobs and corn stover, but the bulk of the cellulosic ethanol, which is going to be around 21 billion gallons, would come from crops other than corn.
So the Energy Policy Act does not cap corn ethanol at 15 billion. That is simply what you anticipate as the capacity for us to grow enough corn to create that many gallons.
Can I answer that question?
Yeah, I think Sangwan is going to add some comments.
Please introduce yourself for the committee.
Yes, this is Sangwan Su. I'm an assistant professor at the Bioproduct and Biosystems Engineering Department at the University of Minnesota. Answering those questions, Energy Policy Act mandate producing 36 billion gallons of ethanol by 2022 and capped ethanol production from corn starch up to 16 billion gallons of ethanol by then, so that the rest of the 36 billion gallons of ethanol, which is 21 billion gallons of ethanol, should come from sources other than corn starch, which is termed in the Energy Policy Act as advanced biofuel, including algae-based biodiesel and corn stover-based ethanol and willow trees or switchgrasses, perennial grasses, etc.
So there is a cap in the Energy Policy Act at,
yes, indeed,
16 billion. Now, and that is about a little over twice of what is currently being produced nationally from corn ethanol. In your opinion, will that require double the corn production that we currently have?
Actually,
Professor Mulla.
The corn production today is increasing at about 1% per year due to improvements in genetic breeding and due to improvements in technology. There is the potential to increase the corn production by going to a three-year rotation of corn, followed by soybeans, which would bring in, you know, an extra year worth of corn production. What these statistics show is that there will be an increasing demand for ethanol from corn. However, these targets are well within the current crop acreages of corn that we produce. It's just that the balance between corn produced for animal feed and corn produced for ethanol will probably shift more and more in favor of ethanol production.
Okay.
In Minnesota, you know, we're probably producing now about 600 million gallons of ethanol from corn, and that could go very easily to about 2 billion gallons of ethanol from corn in the next 3 to 5 years.
In your opinion, regarding the acreage, are we at capacity for our ability to produce enough corn for ethanol, and that that acreage will then have to be rotated a little bit more often for corn in order to meet this 16 billion cap.
Yes, we're certainly beginning to reach those kinds of concerns about having enough corn to produce all the ethanol that's being demanded. And so
well, we're using the acreages, we're pretty much using all the acres that we have for corn in order to double the production for this cap. We'll have to use different rotation practices to get higher. Is that correct?
Right, right. And then the other serious implication is that we have about 300,000 acres of conservation reserve program land that is going to come out of contract in the next 2 to 3 years. And with the high prices for corn and other commodities, there's not much incentive for farmers to re-enroll those lands in CRP. So the USDA is anticipating that roughly one-fifth of all those acres, which are marginal lands and vulnerable to erosion, the USDA is anticipating that 20% of those acres will probably go back into crop production.
So there is more land available through acres that are now enrolled in CRP.
Yes.
Senator Stump, did you have a question? Comment?
Yes, I think... you know, acres kind of switch back and forth. Last year when we had $9 wheat, and I mean, pretty soon the squeeze was on corn because people thought, you know, corn would be the best and most economical, I mean, best revenue crop that to produce, only to find out that wheat was a much better crop. So I think when I first moved up to northern Minnesota, we had very, very few corn acres. And in fact, most of the corn acres that we had up there were usually chopped for silage. But with the new breeding and the hybrids and the shorter season corn, and the now I think there'll be even a greater potential for corn, you know, with the Roundup Ready corn and a host of new things that are coming out in technology and stuff, I think you will have a lot more acres that can be available for crops, but I think you'll also have a much greater swing of crops as the producers, the farmers, start realizing, is this one more profitable than that one? And corn is a high cost crop. When I mean, a little over a year ago, anhydrous was, you know, in the $300 range, and now it's between $700 and $800. So, I mean, there's so many variables that you can swing from one crop to another. And I don't, you know, I think there's, I don't know the numbers of acres, but I think that definitely technology and prices will have an impact on. And, of course, the conservation reserve. And we do have, you know, that is a, that can be a problem, too, because some of the acres that will be coming out maybe should have stayed in.
Did I see the other hand? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe Dr. Miller could answer this. What is the status of the algae-based biofuel? It seemed to me, in terms of achieving a commercial production level, that seemed to hold a lot of promise for the what could the return or what could be gained from even a lesser acreage or impact on environment and other kinds of crops. Do you have to report on that?
Well, the University of Minnesota is actually doing quite a bit of research on, you know, fuel production from algae. And the current thinking is that would be most economic in places where we have wastewater treatment plants that have a ready supply of nutrients. It's less likely that we could actually make algae production for ethanol economical on our landscapes in Minnesota. The problem in Minnesota is we have short growing seasons and relatively cold temperatures most of the year. The biggest potential for using algae to produce fuel is actually in places like the southwestern U.S. and the southern U.S. And Sandia Labs has actually done a very thorough analysis of all the locations in the United States where algae production would be the most economical. And Minnesota is not on that list, I just might say. But it's a promising technology for some areas of the country.
I'd love to, but Mr. Chairman, yes. I wasn't thinking of it just specifically for Minnesota, but we were talking about the capacity amount that's needed if we're going to move in that direction, and that seemed to have a pretty great potential. There's a limited number of acres for producing corn, and I think we're already starting to see a lot of pressure that the more that is put into ethanol production, the higher our cost our corn flakes are going to have, and a few other things, and that impact seems to be already being felt. And if there's pushback there, is the algae actually producing an ethanol, or is it another form of fuel?
Mr. Mullah.
Yes.
Go ahead.
This is Sangwon Su.
Dr. Su.
Thank you. Algae is not producing ethanol. It is producing basically fatty acid, which can be converted into diesel form.
So diesel is
going diesel to- is the end product that we can achieve out of algae.
Okay. Great. Okay. Thank you.
Let's move to Dr. Shardlow. Are you next?
And excuse me. Thank you for your attention. I have to go and teach a class.
Thank you for being here.
This is Jean Coleman again, and I am standing in as a representative for the Land and Aquatic Habitat team, and that none of them were able to make it today. I apologize for that. Briefly, the charge of the Land and Aquatic Habitat team is to look at a landscape scale and map priority areas from both a land habitat and an aquatic habitat perspective for the state of Minnesota. And then, of course, recommend strategies for LCCMR investment and for policy changes to achieve better protection of those priority areas with the trend analysis supporting those recommendations. This team is heavily into mapping and geographic information systems analysis. They are using from the land side two key databases, both developed by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. The Minnesota Species of Greatest Conservation Need is one data source, and the other is the Minnesota Gap Analysis, identifying key habitats and species distribution. And what both of these databases look at are habitat existing and potential habitat for species that are disappearing in Minnesota or are under some type of threat in Minnesota. And then also the second database is looking at a broad range of species that are present as native species in Minnesota, and those being animal species. We are also then looking at large contiguous ecosystems and corridors, so taking those areas that are necessary for biodiversity in our state and connecting them through a ecosystem analysis to create corridors. We are then going to pair that with a threat analysis called change detection, looking at the threats to those corridors, to those areas of biodiversity. And some of the key threats, the key stressors are land use trends, expansion of developing areas, ownership patterns such as in forested areas of Minnesota where changing ownership is going from large tracts under individual ownership to smaller tracts under multiple ownership, population density, and road networks. So those are a sample of the stressors that we will be looking at on those systems. We'll also be looking at current and desirable outdoor recreation areas, outdoor recreation being supported by Minnesota's natural resources and an area of interest of the LCCMR. And then also we will be pairing that land-based analysis with a similar aquatic-based analysis to look at surface and groundwater priorities and mapping those priorities.
Does zoning rules fall into one of those categories somewhere that Senator Dill is referring to?
Chairman Chaudhry, the zoning trend would fall under the change detection or the stressor analysis. So if we can identify where development is occurring and also likely to occur, zoning would be part of that likely to occur analysis.
Thank you.
A couple of maps showing where we're at. We've got a long ways to go on our analysis, mapping analysis. It's a very intensive mapping analysis, particularly looking at statewide resources. Many of the methodology that are being used have been applied at a regional or site-specific scale, but not necessarily at a statewide scale. This map just illustrates the species of greatest conservation need. Those species, animal species, bird species, invertebrate species in Minnesota that the DNR has identified as under some type of threat that they would like to see some protection. This map is shown by a township by township. So the size of the color dots on here are township size dots. And it shows species richness of those species of greatest conservation need by township. And then in the outlined townships, those outlined in white, are the top 10% of townships within each ecological section. I've thrown a lot at you there. So essentially, let me repeat what we've done here. The state of Minnesota is broken down by the dark black lines into ecological subsections, a way of looking at the state that the DNR often looks at the state and do other state agencies. And then within each of those ecological subsections, the top 10% of townships are outlined in blue or in white, and those top 10% are those townships that have the highest number of species of greatest conservation need. If you look at this map long enough, you will see some patterns emerge, and the darkest blue are the highest number of species of greatest conservation need, and you will see a prevalence of that dark color along the Minnesota River, along the Aspen Ridge Line, along the Red River Valley, and then through our Central Lakes and the Minnesota Prairie Coteau area, as well as southeastern Minnesota in the karst region. Another example of the mapping that we are doing, and again, this is a map that you could spend several hours with to understand completely, and I apologize for the swiftness with which I'll review it, is identifying those vulnerable key habitats, not just where species actually occur currently, but where they could occur in the future given restoration of key habitats. Where could waterfowl occur in Minnesota in the future if we restored habitats and kept the habitats that we currently have? The darkest blue color in, again, each ecological subsection shows the townships with the top 10% of vulnerable key habitats for that subsection. One of the reasons that we're using a subsection analysis is to distribute priority areas across Minnesota based on a scientific analysis of ecological subsections, but not just looking at the top distribution if you looked at a statewide distribution. So what are those key habitats in each area of the state? And again, you see some patterns emerge in the blue colors in this map. And then finally, one example which I flashed up earlier as Dr. Muller was speaking is analysis of some trends that we're looking at to support recommendations of where to invest protection dollars in key habitats in Minnesota. This shows the Conservation Reserve Program and the year of expiration of enrolled acreages. The darkest blue are those acreages that are expiring in the near future by 2010. The magenta is in the next tier to 2016, 2015, and then finally the yellow is in 2022. And what this shows us is that there are some key habitat areas in the Red River Valley area, Minnesota River, that are at risk because of potential expiration of CRP lands. We're also looking at trend lines for re-enrollment and taking our knowledge about cropping prices to estimate re-enrollment percentages, and we'll apply that to this trend analysis. But this is a fairly dramatic map for us, saying we could lose much of our conservation land, about 100,000 acres, or a million acres, excuse me, by 2010 if re-enrollment is zero.
Mayor Scogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Coleman, the bar graph sitting in Wisconsin there, my printout doesn't print very well, so what is that saying?
The tallest bar is the first expiration category that we had, 207 to 2010, and it shows it's reaching about a million acres in that first expiration grouping that we had. In the second expiration grouping, which is the bar to the right, the medium-sized bar, those are the acres that expire between 2011 and 2015, and we're at about 450,000 acres. And then the last bar to the right, the shortest bar, is for the period of 2016 to 2020, and we are at about 250,000 acres.
Thank you.
How many of these mapping steps is the habitat team doing? I think you've given two or three examples. Are you doing many more?
Chairman Chowdhury, we will be doing many, many more. I expect that the habitat team will produce a catalog or atlas that would have as many as 20 to 25 mapping layers. We're being challenged right now with the desire to show the results in one comprehensive map versus the ability to understand that comprehensive map, and it appears that what we will do is have a series of maps and then perhaps a compilation map.
Okay.
And a question that commonly comes up with the habitat analysis is, how does this apply to specific priorities on a specific piece of land? And because we're being challenged to look at priorities statewide, what we will likely come up with is our priorities for land and aquatic habitat statewide, and a methodology, if applied at a site scale or a regional scale, could identify parcels of land. One of our challenges in the aquatic land and aquatic habitat team is using statewide databases that are not at a resolution that allow us to go to a single parcel resolution. Some of the databases are in that resolution, but most of them that are statewide are not. So that's a challenge that we're facing. And that is the end of my presentation on the habitat team. Again, that's the landscape scale looking at priorities in Minnesota. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions about that.
Mr. Chair. Mayor Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I'm just kind of curious, you know, land down where I live now is selling $6,000, cash rents $300 an acre. I put 80 acres into a CREP. Thought it was a good deal, but now I'm looking at it. I still think it's a good deal, but money-wise, it wasn't such a wonderful thing to tie that land up for 15 years because it's perpetual. So I think we're going to really have to struggle to save those wetlands, those wildlife areas, because who's buying land down where I live? It's investors. They don't come from southern part of Minnesota. They come from the middle of Minnesota, out investing, lots of money. And then they want to put out the cash rent, which my young farmers can't afford to even come close to doing that. So I think you're going to see corn is going to be, you know, you can easily get $500 an acre. Corn's $5. You probably could get $1,000 an acre. The trend is up in Stump's area, wheat is $20 a bushel. So if you could even come close to doing it, half a wheat crop is better than a full corn crop when you take the expense that goes between them. Some way we have to curb this, and I'd like to freeze it all, but I can't. I'm scared to death on what's going to happen with the farm bill if they're going to open that all up. Some of that CRP, that'd be destroyed our rural area who's fought so hard for wildlife habitat. And I hope that we can keep a hand on that so that doesn't happen.
Ms. Coleman.
If I may, Chairman Chaudhry and Senator Vickerman, the Habitat team has been struggling with exactly that question in regards to recommendations. Do we make a recommendation, as you suggest, that bars landowners from exiting the Conservation Reserve Program, or do we use a recommendation that brings the incentive for conservation inequity to the incentive for production? And is there a mix of incentives that we might use for conservation? A challenge for each of the teams is to look at the natural resources benefit through a lens of economics. And you heard some of that from Professor Mulla. You'll also hear that from the landscape team and the land use practices team. We recognize that there is a curve for maximum economic benefit, and there is a curve for maximum environmental benefits, and we need to land where both of those curves are maximized, not where one outstrips the other, if your goal is to protect natural resources and have a thriving economy.
So. An excellent.
Well, Mr. Chair, we should go back, like I tried to do before, make it all perpetual, or else it didn't get any money. That's the key. It should have been perpetual. It really should have. But you can't get people to do that. But that way you protect it, so you never, it's always going to be there for wildlife. You can sell it. When I can sell that land if I want. It can never be farmed.
There's someone, though.
Now, someday one of my children will inherit that. One of my two boys live in the cities. I could see him say, gosh, Dad, you know, I'll be gone. But they could say to me, $6,000 an acre isn't too bad when I live in the metro and don't really hunt or don't really fish. That's a problem I face. And I know we can't do perpetual, but I'm a firm believer in it. We should lock that in, and it stays locked in.
I wish we could, too, Senator. I wish we could. What I was going to mention is that an excellent tool for that balance that you're looking for is winter wheat. And you could end up getting a good crop, a good profit, and good habitat, just as you do with some of these biofuel cellulosic proposals. Winter wheat could also be part of the mix, and hopefully that'll be one of the strategic recommendations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
I'm trying to carry a bill to help Chautauqua wind farms down in my Lake Chautauqua.
It's not too common.
They raise a lot of money, but right now it's on hold. I don't think they're going to do anything till 2015. For the simple reason, they can't get permission to go from A to B. They can't get the grid lines in there. They won't allow them to do it. So So it's nice to talk about the windmills, and I'm glad they aren't, but the new ones, unless you can get some kind of an agreement that you can go across land and get to where the power should be, it's going to be a tough slit.
Senator, you may not have spoken clearly enough. I didn't say windmills. I said winter wheat would be a good way to strike that balance. Good habitat, but also, and particularly with the price of wheat now, could be very advantageous economically. So let's continue.
Thank you. This is a very expansive topic, and appreciate your attention. It's especially right after lunch. It's a big topic to take on. So I'll try and pick up the pace just a little bit. I'm the chair of the land use practices team, and just to remind you, we'll be making recommendations for conservation strategies that'll have to do with where the LCCMR might prioritize its spending, and also things that need to be protected the most. We'll be looking at a lot of trend information to identify where are the most concerns, if you will, and then also making recommendations for research. When we presented to the LCCMR, we got very clear feedback that some members didn't want to do more mapping and weren't interested in more research. They wanted to spend some money where it was going to make a difference. We will, I believe, be identifying some key gaps in some of the research and identifying some places where we think some additional information would put us in a far better position to make decisions. We'll also be talking about pilot projects or demonstration projects, and then again, for several of these, looking at potential policy changes as well. So a good deal of the work that's been done so far has been looking at trend information, and we do that for a couple of reasons. I wanted to just remind us as we're thinking about this, kind of how the land use practices team is organized. We're looking at really three different areas. One is forest, the other is agriculture, and the third is urban.
And just for the tape, Dr. John Shardlow.
I didn't actually complete my doctorate, but except through the School of Hard Knocks. John Shardlow, I'm a principal with the firm of Bonestro in the Twin Cities.
So almost Dr. Sean John Shardlow. Thank you.
We are broken up into subcommittees because of the distinctions between the forest issues and agricultural and urban issues. In each of those, we are working to identify trends. And the reason why we're looking at those trends are really twofold. One is to illuminate problems. As we look at the trends, we're seeing existing problems and projecting how those problems will be exacerbated in the future. But also using those trends to try and guide where our priorities are. We continuously come back to the sort of most bang for the buck kind of analogy. Where should we spend our dollars to get the most results? And then finally, because land use in all of these areas is so directly tied to transportation, we're coordinating very closely with the transportation group. One example of the types of trends that we are looking at is this one, which is one where we have pretty good information. And it's a trend which shows the increases in impervious surfacing between 1990 and 2000, again, broken down into different regions in the state. If we're looking at expansions of urban areas where it's running up against forest area and agricultural area and conversion and so forth, trends with respect to impervious surface is one of the good indicators of areas where we need to be focused. But again, we're also looking at that relationship between land use and transportation. And so some of the trend information that we're looking at there are the increases in vehicle miles traveled per person in Minnesota from 1970 to 2004. So at this point in the process, we're broken down into three subcommittees. We have a subcommittee that's coming up with draft recommendations with respect to land use practices in agriculture, another in forest, and another in urban. And I think it's important distinction to make that the land use practices team is really focused on those things that we do on individual parcels of ground. The land habitat and aquatics team is looking at that on a much broader scale. We're looking at how you operate a particular farm or how you manage a particular forest or how you manage the growth of a particular urban area. So with respect to the types of recommendations that we're going to be coming forward with, I've intentionally kept that general because I don't want you to think that we're focused on that. We're really at a very broad thinking, brainstorming part of the process. But the types of examples of recommendations that we might be coming forward with would be recommendations that would tend to limit urban sprawl, for instance. How can we use land more efficiently? How can we do infill and redevelopment more efficiently? And how can we grow our urban areas in a more compact pattern? The other part is how can we use the areas that we've already urbanized or we're going to urbanize better? And that's the full cadre of tools with low-impact development and so forth. And then finally, because we have limited resources, we're going to be trying to look at recommendations that would have multiple benefits. An example there would be if we can develop a more compact development pattern, it could also tend to reduce vehicle miles traveled, which would have less greenhouse gases and a lower carbon footprint. Happy to answer any questions.
Ben, this is Jean Coleman again. I hope I'm not stepping on anybody's question, but I'll proceed. We've got two more slides to just give you a snapshot of what we're doing to evaluate our conservation strategies. And Professor Sangwon Su will talk about the cost-benefit analysis, which is really integral to our evaluation of recommendations.
This is Sangwon Su. I'm relatively new here. It has been 2.5 years since I've moved here from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. So once we have gathered all the recommendations from the teams, which I envisage about over a dozen of different recommendations, key question here is that how to prioritize some of the good recommendations that we will need to move forward. Of course, it is not an easy question because those recommendations will be very different in terms of their nature and their impact and cost associated with those recommendations. So we do not have, well, basically we will need to compare apples and oranges, and we do not have good ways of doing that, objective ways of doing that. So basically the approach that we are using is that cost-benefit analysis team is trying to facilitate an organized discussion to review the repercussions of cost side and benefit side of those recommendations and try to see those recommendations in different angles. For instance, if the biofuel development is one of the recommendations, well, we have so much of land in the curbside and the marginal land around the road, this is so good. However, do we have enough transportation infrastructure and harvest infrastructure in order to realize those biofuel benefits, biofeedstock benefits? Or the CLP land the same? Do we have enough road infrastructure to transport those biofeedstocks into conversion facilities? Or in terms of biofuel conversion facilities, do we have enough water to feed those biofuel plant? A gallon of ethanol requires 3 to 4 gallons of water using corn stover, corn starch, or it can use 6 to 9 gallons of water per gallon of ethanol in order to utilize corn stover or other cellulosic bioethanol. So what we are trying to do here is to put those recommendations into a broader context of socioeconomic and political and biophysical constraint and see what are the costs and benefits arising from those recommendations so that we can have a more critical look on each recommendations and hopefully we can prioritize some of the cost-effective recommendations out of the recommendations that are coming up from those teams. So basically, recommendations will be flowing into our team from energy and energy team and land use team and land and water habitat team, and we'll try to describe what are the costs and benefits associated with those recommendations and envisage magnitude of costs and benefits in qualitative sense, so very high or high, medium or low, etc., and then we'll try to compare those recommendations thereof. So any questions or suggestions, I would welcome.
How will your cost-benefit analysis take into account climate change? Will it? Are you anticipating potential costs and potential benefits of climate change?
The quick answer would be yes. But I wanted to make sure that what we are trying to do in terms of cost-benefit analysis is not accurately measuring the exact amount of cost or benefits associated with different recommendations, because there are simply, two higher uncertainties associated with issues with climate change, and anything that we recommend here would involve significant uncertainties. Instead, we are trying to say that, well, the cost would be very high or high, or the benefit would be high or very high, including those issues with climate change as well. For instance, if we are dealing with cellulosic biomass-based biofuels, certainly it will contribute to the lowering climate greenhouse gas emissions from Minnesota. How much does it contribute to lowering overall greenhouse gas emissions and achieving the benefits from preventing climate change is questionable. Those kind of things we will discuss about and we will think about. However, we will not quantify those benefits or costs associated with those recommendations.
I'm just thinking of examples like, will a longer growing season be beneficial or not beneficial? Obviously, you can grow things longer, but you probably will have less moisture. Mm-hmm. So will that be analyzed? What is the effect of our effect on economic effects on a resort industry of a later ice in and an earlier ice out? Are those types of things that would be taken into account, for example?
Well, when some of the recommendations will involve considerations like what the chairman said, then apparently we will consider different options and different costs and benefits associated with them, including those that you have mentioned.
If I may also, Chairman Chaudhry, the climate change issue, if you read our background report, the first phase report, really is described as an overarching issue. Each of the teams that are working on this project are challenged by how to incorporate climate change trends in their analysis. And for example, the habitat team constantly is discussing if we project habitat for the current suite of species in Minnesota, is that sufficient given climate change trends? And the conclusion is we are less certain about climate change trends than we are about the current suite of species in Minnesota. We can confidently say that suite of species will change given climate change, but we can't analyze at this point in time exactly how that habitat will change. I anticipate, although we've got several months still to write the report, I anticipate the report will bring that climate change issue in a similar way to the Phase 1 report as an overarching discussion and its implications to the recommendations that are made based on current trends.
Senator Dill?
Mr. Chair and witnesses, on the planning and zoning end of things, land use planning, generally we've left that up to local units of government. And the state has done relatively little to order local units of government around in that area. The biggest exception was the 1991 Wetland Conservation Act, which was basically a planning and zoning wetlands law for the whole state of Minnesota. And then we did order everybody around. And there are a few other examples, too, where if you look in state law, you'll see some things we've told local units of government to do. Do you envision that with your recommendations that you'd want the state to tell local units of government what to do in terms of planning and zoning? Or should we try to leave it, you know, give them some recommendations and leave it up to them and hope they do what they're supposed to do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the types of recommendations that we're currently formulating would be examples of potential grants available to cities, provided that they were to conduct a plan in a certain way to meet certain criteria. So it would be more incentive-based, more carrot than stick, if you will. I've been doing this business for 30 years, and I've been involved in planning over 100 cities in Minnesota throughout the state. And I've been a participant in the Community-Based Planning Act. I've been a participant in cities in the metropolitan area that got some grants from the Metropolitan Council. And my observation is that a relatively small amount of incentive was enough to get cities to do a great deal with respect to planning. So our hope is to follow that experience from the past and to put forth some opportunities for communities to access certain incentive funds, provided that they conduct a plan that would meet certain conditions and criteria.
If I might,
Ms. Coleman.
Thank you, Chairman Senator Dill. I would like to convey to the committee some marching orders that the LCCMR have given us consistently, and that is to present them with bold and unfiltered recommendations. We are at a point right now where we are brainstorming those recommendations, so I can't say yes emphatically that we would come up with such a recommendation that would shift the balance between local control of land use. However, we are thinking certainly in those terms. They're on the table. We'll see what comes out in the end, and I appreciate your input.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up. The one thing we do know for certain is, particularly when it comes to natural resource systems, that they go beyond local jurisdictional lines. And so the best land use planning that's happening around the state of Minnesota is when multiple jurisdictions get together to plan together. And so those will be some of the examples that we'll be holding up as models and some of the things that we'll be trying to direct local units of government toward.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Charlotte, do you think you'll have any impact on Met Council, which seems to have the appearance of applying the same kind of density rules to everybody, no matter what kind of the lay of the land is that they have?
Mr. Shardlow.
One of the members of our team is Tom Weaver, who is the assistant executive, assistant administrator.
He is the administrator.
He is the administrator. Excuse me. And it was very important to us to have him as a member of our committee. We also have representatives of the Builders Associations, the League of Cities, Association of Counties, the Association of Townships, and many other stakeholders. So, again, we're coming at this from the standpoint of really trying to give some our best advice in terms of how we think we should use our land. And there certainly isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. Forgive me, but if you look at that map that had all the CRP land with when it's coming out of that program, that can be kind of a scary thing to think about. But it's also an opportunity, in that we know a lot about the suitability of land and what land is best suited for which of these different crop types that Dr. Muller was talking about. So it does give us the chance to try and put programs in place that would direct that land toward the types of crops that it would best suited for. Likewise, when it comes to land use, there definitely are cities that are well suited for very high density, where an investment is anticipated with respect to transit, and we need to make sure that we take full advantage of that. But you aren't going to have the same levels of density in downtown Minneapolis that you have in fertile Minnesota. So there has to be some reason that gets brought into that discussion as well.
If I could,
Ms. Coleman.
Thank you, Chairman. We greatly appreciate being here today, and we view this as an opportunity to hear from you, your opinions on potential recommendations. And Senator Olson and Senator Dill have hinted, or more than hinted, at some recommendations that they feel might be appropriate, but I would love to have any input from this committee or individual members about potential recommendations that you would see having ultimately a better impact on Minnesota's natural resources.
Ms. Coleman, what occurs next? Where do we go from today?
And, Chairman, do you refer to we being the committee or we being our team?
Your team.
Thank you. Where we are going next is these teams are charged with producing recommendations for the LCCMR in June of 2008. They are all churning through a brainstorm set of recommendations and applying some analysis as to whether or not they believe the trends will be improved through particular recommendations. We're still working on the mapping of priority areas. One thing that will occur between now and June, as we develop more fully those recommendations, is a stakeholder outreach effort. Even though we have a very large team and we've had over 100 individuals from the University of Minnesota, the consulting teams and state agencies and other partners involved in these teams, we realize we have not heard from other stakeholders, and there are more out there. And so we will be taking our draft recommendations to additional stakeholders in April of this year in three different locations across the state, getting them to work through the recommendations, understanding the trend and the scientific analysis behind them, and bringing their filters from their organizations to those recommendations. Not voting on whether or not they should go forward, but providing additional input, stakeholder input, to our team, which then will make recommendations to the LCCMR. That's where we're going. Our final report will be available at the end of June. And in the meantime, any input from this committee would be appreciated.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Coleman, thank you for asking for some advice. I have some advice for you, which I'll pass out when you get done with your testimony, but it's a copy of the bill I've got a hearing on tomorrow, plus some attached information.
Thank you.
Other questions?
What is that?
Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We were planning to show a movie, but it's about an hour long, and so we're not going to do that today. Other things to come before this committee? Otherwise, we stand adjourned.